Hello, my name is Julian Chambliss. It's October 24th, 2020. I am doing a Zoom recording with Dr. Erik Steinkuss, who is from the University of Copenhagen. He's a scholar of Afrofuturism. Erik, do I have your permission to record you?
Yes, sure.
Erik, do I have your permission to use elements of this recording for the podcast entitled Everyone's Got to Confess?
Absolutely.
Eric, do you understand that the recording that you're about to make will be added to an archive called Voices of the Black Imaginary, and that archive will be available for students and the public for the purposes of education and research?
Yes, I do, and I'm happy to participate.
Thank you. Put those formalities out of the way, the legality out of the way. And there will be some additional paperwork I'll send you, like a release form. As I've indicated, this interview is about the history and theory about Afrofuturism, but in particular around sound. So the participants of this interview cycle are related to sound and Afrofuturism. As a result, my first question for you, as someone who has written about and thought about sound, is how do you define Afrofuturism and what is the relationship to sound in that definition?
There's always something about the definitions. As you said, I'm in Copenhagen now, and I'm originally from Norway, and in a sense, then I'm kind of an outsider, and wanting to sort of push my definitions into an Afrofuturist community would be tricky. It would be something I don't want to do. So, of course, when I started working with the term and the concept myself, I read what other people had written. We all quote the so-called origin of the term from Mark Derry, where we learn to add something from Yutasha Womack, we learn to add something from Reinaldo Anderson. And in that sense, the term is still, I would say, still not defined once and for all. It's still a kind of a dynamic term, but it is obviously at its origin, it was, I would say, US-centric. So it was about African American community more than necessarily an Afro-diasporic community or a community of people in Africa and the African diaspora. And that then I already hinted at some kind of expansion of the discourse, because at least after the year 2000, it's not only related to African American context, but it originates in understanding, as far as I can see, understanding the relation between science fiction, technology, and the contemporary world through an African American lens, as a negotiation of the possibility of thinking the future from an African American perspective. That's where I see it coming from. And when I say thinking, it's of course not only thinking, it's also doing all kinds of artistic practices that are part of building this future, are part of negotiating the future, are part of trying to understand the future. Thus, for me, music, as a musicologist, music becomes extremely important. And when I wrote my book, Afrofuturism and Black Sound Studies, I was sort of trying to figure out where is there a kind of a border between an Afrofuturist music and a black music that is not necessarily Afrofuturist, but it's related either by genre or by sounds or by ways of thinking. So for me, even thinking what Afrofuturism might be is almost changing every time I sit down to write about it. I try to sort of see, okay, what have colleagues, what have practitioners come up with since my last publication, and should I adjust the term a bit? Sometimes I think that I should be kind of careful about it and sort of see what is the difference between Afrofuturism, what Kodjo Eshun called sonic fiction, and what you could also call a kind of an imaginary music, or a kind of music of sci-fi music in one way or another. Is it necessarily Afrofuturist? I do a lot of work both in jazz and R&B, funk and popular music. And I don't necessarily want to use the term Afrofuturism so that whenever there's a music video with a spaceship in it, it has to be an Afrofuturist music video. There's some Afrofuturist aesthetics to it, but I want to sort of try to distinguish between when are the artists trying to expand on how we perceive the world, past, present, and future, and when is the Afrofuturist aesthetics more of a hype thing, so to speak. I mean, there's a popular Afrofuturism. Personally, I don't mind that, but I think that we need to sort of dig into those artists that are really trying to think about what their music contributes to society. They are, for me as a scholar, a bit more interesting to work with than simply saying that this is a sort of a generalized aesthetic or field of thinking. So for me, it's about negotiation with about the future, but not only about the future, because the future is sort of dependent on what stories we tell from the past. And so there's also an archaeological, so to speak, cultural archaeological dimension to Afrofuturism, seeing what kind of stories have not been told or what kind of stories have been told in minor communities or outside of school or whatever, and need to be brought up. I'm thinking about an old piece like George James's Stolen Legacy, which is a piece arguing that a lot of Greek philosophy came from Egypt. And I see that as a kind of historical intervention into European ways of thinking history and to sort of go further back in history than normal European history, which often kind of have a prehistory before Greece. And then with Greece, we are Europe proper, so to speak. And that means that negotiating an Egyptian or an African presence before that Greek thing can sort of get us to think about the Eurocentrism of a lot of things being done in the universities, especially over here, and how that is a limited perspective also on understanding the past and what kind of pasts we can use to think about the future. So it's I discuss in my book something I call sonic time travel, which is a kind of about imagining sounds both from the past and the future and renegotiating historical layers of sonic material, which helps me think about how music both participate in history and is at the same time a way of constructing a historical awareness through musical styles, musical figures, particular instruments that connote different cultural contexts and different historical layers. So for me, the Afrofuturist perspective is also a way to challenge the way I write, the way I think about history. I try to sort of adapt it as methodology as well, in a way, in a sense that to challenge my scholarly upbringing, so to speak, as a musicologist, and say that if this music is actually working to other ends, it's actually doing different things than the music I grew up with or the music I studied in the university, then I also need to methodologically adapt to that music. So the music is actually also helping me to think differently as a scholar, especially when it comes to time, imagination, futurity. The whole thing about how does the future sound is an extremely interesting question for me, because we can imagine some future sounds, but if we have to produce them, how do we produce sounds that sort of denote something unknown or something futuristic? We do it by constructing new instruments, by plugging the instruments into electricity, by using computers, and not all music using synthesizers are about the future, but a lot of music using synthesizers actually use those synthesizers as a way to indicate new sounds coming into being, so to speak, sounds that points us towards a future in our imagination and in our reception of it. And for me, that is one of the one of the great things about working with music without lyrics, without song titles and so on, because then you can actually also in that music discuss futurity or futurism. Whereas, of course, if you have music videos, you have lyrics, you have people singing about being robots or being from outer space, then, of course, that outer space or the sci-fi dimension is already there in everything else than the sounds. And it helps me to sort of figure out how the sounds communicate in and of themselves, but in addition, so to speak, to lyrics and pictures and music videos and so on. So that's the kind of work I'm doing across. I've primarily worked on African American music so far in this project, but I'm starting to think that I want to learn more about Caribbean music. I want to learn more about popular music from the African continent and see how what I've been doing so far may or may not go into a dialogue with music from other places than the United States as well.
So I really appreciate that answer. And I think in how I follow up with that is, as a musicologist, your answer indicates that you've been on a kind of methodological journey. And, mm-hmm. In particular, I'm struck by Coach O'Shea talked at one point about a musological turn.
Mm-hmm.
Like musing differently. I interpreted it as musing differently. And so, you know, from as a musicologist who's steeped in a field in the literature about sound, how has Afrofuturism sort of factored into this nascent ideological framework that you indicated in your definitional answer? You talk very specifically in your answer about this question of, there's a European element that defines the sort of academic community that you're in. But there's also this question of the nature and interventions represented by Afrofuturism, which I think is like a recurring monolith across all definitions. It doesn't matter whose definition that you use, be it, as you say, Mark Derry, or Natasha Womack, or Alonzo Nelson, or Ronaldo Anderson, there is this question of intervention. So there's this sort of epistemology question that becomes very important. And as a scholar who's deep in a field and also trying to create sort of definitional boundaries or pushing definitional boundaries, what has that journey been like? What is that stake for you as a scholar who thinks about Afrofuturism and sound when you explore that work?
Yeah, that's a great question and a complicated one, because it moves on so many different layers. There's actually both some similarities and some dissimilarities, and I'll come to the similarities towards the end because that's actually where it gets fun for me. But I have a traditional, so to speak, but not quite, a university education. I have a double major in musicology and philosophy, and then went on to write a doctorate in musicology. And I was working with primarily 20th century compositional music, so-called classical music. Well, it's not really classical when it's 20th century, but you know what I mean. And in my doctorate, I wrote about a German language opera from the early 1930s by Arnold Schoenberg called Moses and Aaron, which is about, the story of the opera is about Moses leaving Egypt and in search for the promised land, and the opera ends in the desert after he has gotten the law and so on. But it's a story about the origin of the Jewish people, and it's done in a 12-tone opera style. And I spent almost 4 years working with that opera, and it was great fun. But I used a lot of philosophical theories, cultural theories, in addition to working with the score and seeing the performance and so on. So I'm educated in with a basis in European classical tradition, score reading, analyzing musical notation, but then adding philosophical and cultural interpretation theory to that. And during my during the period I was working with that, I did every interdisciplinary thing I could on the Moses figure, from history and Egyptology and cultural theory. And I started to work with questions of race, about how the Jews were seen in the 20s and 30s in Europe, and what this writing an opera about Jewishness in 1930s Europe could have, Germany could have been. So and I figured out quite early, actually, that you could not discuss race without also discussing gender and sexuality. And then you can hear that my introduction into discussions of racialization, race, gender, and so on comes from a pretty particular place, and moved into other kinds of work after I did my doctorate, actually. Still as a postdoc, I was working primarily with European opera, but I started to collaborate with scholars doing so-called popular music studies, which is huge over here, obviously, also in musicology. And I've become more and more a scholar. I try to do that crossover all the time, but I've been more and more a scholar that teaches classes in popular music studies at large, with a particular focus on African-American American music. But in addition to that, I was also working with European philosophy, critical theory of the 30s in Frankfurt, in Germany, French so-called postmodernist philosophy, and reading up on cultural theory. But then there's the other part of almost all musicologists have a history of having played music and being musical fans and having listened to a lot of music. And I know that I heard Sun Ra's music on album for the first time when I was 13 or 14 years old or something like that. And I started to play the saxophone, and I played jazz until I started writing my doctorate, when I didn't have time to practice any longer. And there's, at some point, I also read jazz magazines. I read a lot about the free jazz movement, which was the music I felt closest to. Saxophone players of the 60s, so-called spiritual jazz or whatever. That was sort of my music. So I was doing that. In the evenings, I was playing that music. And in the daytime, I was reading about European compositional music. And they fit together in my musical identity, so to speak. And then I read Paul Gilroy's work on the Black Atlantic, and I read Cody Ashton's More Brilliant Than the Sun, and started to figure out how I could actually combine my intellectual interest in questions of race and gender and the music that I really, really like a lot. I found some ways I could do that. And from Cordio Ashton's book, I found There Is Definition. I found I started to read up on African American history or Black history, and it was just this feeling that I have come to a really place that I really want to be intellectually, but I need to read a lot because I want to go into conversations with African Americans that are doing this work, and I need to know more about the whole context of Black existence in America, because as an outsider, I want to be respectful to a tradition that I'm at the same time critically intervening in. And it means a bit paradoxically that this two times as good thing actually works the opposite way of what it normally does. Now, I have to know that I know this music very well, and also have to be humble towards other kinds of experiences that I don't know about. I mean, some of the first times I've discussed this with a lot of friends and colleagues, what I'm as curious about as their definition of Afrofuturism is actually, okay, what TV shows did you see growing up? What kind of music did you listen to? What kind of European music do you know, and so on? Because I want to know where both the artist, the art, and also the scholarly conversations, where they come from. I really like to know other people's intellectual history, so to speak. But the similarity between what I did with the opera, or still do partly, and what I did with what I do with the Afrofuturist or African American music now is that, and this comes to your question of method as well, I actually want the material I write about to determine how I write about it. So I want partly to read the method out of the work rather than coming to the work with a predefined method. So in that sense, when I talk about sonic time travel, it's because that's something I hear in Sun Ra's music. That's something I hear in the way that Flying Lotuses use examples. That's some of the ways that I hear a lot of African American music actually being in constant negotiation with earlier times in history. It's a version of Amiri Baraka's changing same argument, basically. Changing same as a time-traveling experience, where there's something new and there's something of the tradition that is reinvented again and again. And I find that in the music I write about. So I was sort of trying to figure out how can this become a coherent way of presenting my thoughts about the music.
And I want to follow up on that methodological point, because I think one of the things that is a struggle for the public and even for scholars is that at one level, sound is the most accessible manifestation of Afrofuturism because you've heard it before. Mm-hmm. You heard about Afrofuturism. Like, I teach a class, intro class on Afrofuturism. And whenever we get to the sound section, it's always like, it seems like there's less pressure on the students because they're like, I like this and I didn't think to call it that. But then once they see it, it's really easy for them to go like, okay, this is Afrofuturist because of this, right? So the distinguishing, as you say, there's a spaceship in it, a foreigner. I mean, like Foreigner is a band from the 1970s. I've looked at some of their album covers. I think one of them has a spaceship on it. They're not Afrofuturists, they're a bunch of white guys. They're not.
Sure.
But Sun Ra, every scholar of sound at some level will mention a Sun Ra. Mm. And they will mention George Clinton. Mm. And they will mention, to a lesser extent, but they will mention Lee Perry. And they'll mention Earth, Wind, and Fire. And there becomes a kind of, I think a kind of theoretical slipperiness, because is it because they have a kind of cosmic element to them, or is it like it's the lyrics or is the instruments? And when I talk to students, like it's intersections that make something Afrofuturist, right? Not the one thing. It's all the things coming together in a very particular way. And then I think a lot of people who are Afrofuturists articulate a philosophy that when you hear it, you go like, okay, that's Afrofuturist. And that's how you distinguish someone who's got spaceships, a particular kind of costume, and so on and so forth. So for you as someone who's made this significant methodological turn and created this framework, who are the artists that exemplify what you're talking about? And how has elevating them in the center of your work sort of helped you in that methodological turn?
Well, there's so much you could say about it. It for me as a musicologist, I always like what you point out, that in so many ways music is very accessible to students, also in other departments, also scholarly programs and so on. At the same time, there's an old tradition that non-musicologists find it really hard to write about music. It's much more easy to write about the staging or the album covers and so on. And I really like that kind of conversation between musicologists, musicians, and non-musicologists to continuously expand on that conversation. How can we become better to talk about the sonic dimensions and the use of sound as meaningful dimensions, and of course it's no surprise to also say that for throughout history for African Americans, people of African descent in the U.S., sound, music, and so on has been an extremely important part of the cultural archive as well. So we need to sort of be able to think of sound as archival material as well, not only archives as something written or whatever. And I really like that kind of commitment, forced or voluntary commitment to sound as a historical archive as well. Meaning that I would say that, for example, the metaphor, or what to call it, of Jess Grew in Ishmael Reed's Mumbo Jumbo is actually also a kind of that archive, that virus resembles something that also is part of music. I mean, you get this kind of ragtime craze, and or you get something at a core of a historical understanding that is actually sonic, that is a sound that is communicated from generation to generation and with some differences. So that said, then I also think that composers, musicians, they actually also think with sounds. So one of my tasks as a scholar is to sort of not translate the sound into meaning, but to give my take on what kind of meaning it could be, where we, I mean, nothing I write about music makes sense, I think, if not real sense, if the reader is not at the same time listening to the music and saying, okay, I can relate to that, or no, I hear something different. I need to write and challenge him. What he is hearing is not the full content there. And that is how I see my own intervention as a way of keeping the conversation about how music means alive, not necessarily what it means, but how it means, and give my take on it. I'm a huge also fan, but for me, Sun Ra is probably the most important musician composer ever. Sometimes I give that 2-hour introduction lecture to Sun Ra, which is really, really hard to do because there's so much you always want to talk about. But yes, that's also because of his vision, his philosophy, his way of discoursing around the music. But even if you took all that away and just listened to the albums, you don't need, I mean, I never got to see him before he left the planet, but I've seen the orchestra several times, and I know I'm in communication with several of the members there, and they have told me stories and so on. All those stories are interesting, but even in the sounds, you can hear that he is constructing a sonic epistemology dealing with the sounds of the world from a prehistoric Africa to a future outer space. And he's doing that by how he uses interlocking rhythms on a lot of percussion instruments, which is still some of the music material that a lot of more both traditional and contemporary African music, both East and West Africa, is built upon. And of course, it's not archival sounds. It's not as it sounded 500 years ago, but it's his vision of how it sounded 500 years ago that he illustrates and take into the 20th century by having his musicians playing something that is how we would imagine the past to have sounded. So you have use of drums, you have use of on some albums you have more than one bass player, where you get this you get this kind of bass foundation to a lot of improvisation going on top of it. And then also he engaged with the whole history of black music in the U.S., going back to ragtime, playing swing, playing bebop-like music, playing funk music. His UFO track is pure funk, but it's going a bit out of sync rhythmically compared to what Parliament Funkadelic was doing at the same time. So he's at one and the same time alluding to popular music, other kind of music around him, and doing it his way. So he's showing that all this long history of sound as a way of establishing community and keeping a history alive and an archive, he's showing us this in practice. And then probably the most futuristic dimension of his playing is that he was really, really early in using electronic keyboards, electric pianos, and synthesizers. And you can see that continue in the 70s with Stevie Wonder and Herbie Hancock. And there's not many people that have discussed Stevie Wonder and Afrofuturism, but I happen to think that not necessarily his whole production, but there's also some tracks there where there's some kind of Afrofuturist vibe to his music in the same way that it is in Herbie Hancock, which also brings us to the Earth, Wind & Fire example you mentioned. What Earth, Wind & Fire is doing, and it's also important in the history of I would say, Afrofuturist sound, in that they are it's a more popular music, it's more well known, they were more commercially successful than Parliament Funkadelic, even though a lot of us would of course know both, and there's something extremely important. It's a bit like the Black Panther movie. There's something extremely important by artists bringing Afrofuturist potential out to a general audience, because if it's on a subcultural level, I mean, we can groove to it, we can have a lot of fun with it, we can be scholars, but if this music is also to have cultural and political consequences, there's something interesting to see towards the mass media dimension as well. And it is interesting also with your question, because there's obviously now an Afrofuturist musical canon. There's some musicians we all mention if we start talking about this. And I think we are at the stage now in the discussion on Afrofuturism and music, we're on the stage now where it's important to even be self-critical about how we repeat that canon, or are there other artists that should be included and so on. And for me, one of the musicians I really want to include as well, and I write a bit about her in my book, is Alice Coltrane, who was also married to John Coltrane, but also recorded a lot of music in her own right with it's a lot of it is a spiritual music. It has references to both old Egypt and to African spirituality, but also to Indian spirituality. She ran an ashram in California for a long time, where she was doing spiritual music in the ashram. And it doesn't sound sci-fi or futuristic, but there's something about a kind of a cosmic consciousness around her music that I think is interesting to sort of put into a dialogue and a discussion with the Afrofuturist canon. Kadueshun is doing some of the same in his book, so it's not my invention, but I think there's more material to do there. And one of the things that she is challenging me to as well is to ask the question of gender, to ask the question of whether artists see the Afrofuture or Afrofuturist differently, but based in gendered or sex positions as well. That is not only to do with black or black and white, but that a female or a feminist or a female located Afrofuturism might ask some different questions. I mean, normatively, a lot of jazz and jazz history has been a very male domain. Technology studies used to be talked about as a male domain, which is obviously wrong, but it's important to sort of again come up with the counter histories to that male centric dimension of a lot of what we have been doing when we wrote the history of popular music in the 20th century as well. So the history needs to be taught again, and we need to go out of the canon to introduce other artists. I think this is much better captured these days than it was only 20 years ago as well. I think Janelle Monáe has done a lot for a popularization of an Afrofuturist framework in music. I even think some of Beyoncé's recent material can be read through an Afrofuturist lens, and you can get something interesting out of it. I like that those two modes, to say that some music might actually be Afrofuturist and some music may not, but reading it through an Afrofuturist lens can bring out something that might actually be of value to discuss. And I also think in the field of speculative fiction, there's so many female authors now that really are contributes to the conversation, that I also think that if it was a bit male in the old days, some of the examples we choose to write about, I think that is changing now. So we will see the canon will become broader, and we will discuss other musicians as well into later classes in Afrofuturism. From here and the next 10 years, when we teach in universities, I've been lucky enough to teach Afrofuturism class 3 times over here even. I think that we will have a renegotiation of the canonic material that was sort of used to build the field. I think the field is stable enough now that we can challenge our own canonic assumptions to continue to build.
I really appreciate that answer, in part because I am always concerned, as I think everyone is, when they think about Afrofuturism, especially in the contemporary moment, about what's at stake. And what I would like to ask you is to think about, sometimes when I codify what's Afrofuturist for a class, I'm always mindful of like, well, every definition has its limitations, but I often point students that there are 5 things that I think you should look for. Like one thing is a kind of Black feminism. Another is a kind of aesthetic language. Another is like an emphasis on community. Another is a kind of different kind of science narrative. And is that 5? Community science, visuals, Black feminism. But those issues sort of like bring that totality, right? Like if it's one thing or not the other, right? And that becomes like a way for us to think about the stakes, because of course in my class, probably your class too, we start with a definition and we talk about Mark Berry and like we, you know, immediately start to problematize that because like that's 1994, but there's a Black speculative practice that's captured in that term, and that we need to recognize that Mark Berry captured with that term a practice. And then so when we go looking for it, can we see it in 1880? Well, yeah, we can see it because if you look at a literary work like Sutton Griggs or Hopkins, like, well, if you see these intersections, that makes it Afrofuturist. Sometimes really easy, but sometimes really hard, right? And so what's at stake becomes this sort of like knowledge recognition / creation context. And also this goes to this question of diaspora, like the scope of Afrofuturism, which I think is both one of its strengths and also one of its tensions in the contemporary landscape. And again, I'm mindful that the conversations I'm having are about a movement that has reached a kind of, as you alluded to, a critical moment in its intellectual cultural penetration. Because it's been going on for, you know, probably since 1994. And we can all point to pivotal moments where like, there was a lot of activity around thinking about this, Alondra Nelson and the Afrofuturist mad, blah, blah, blah. But something in particular is happening now. And you know, as I indicate, like, you know, what's at stake is one question, but there's a broader question about definitions, and you even alluded to it when you were talking about publics and counterpublics. You know, I think about this in that way. Like, are we creating in Afrofuturism a new kind of public, and what are the implications of that public? Or are we creating a counterpublic that seeks to destabilize an oppressive mainstream or normalized public? And so when you think about the stakes that are represented by this intellectual activism, How do you frame that? How do you think about what's at stake with this work?
I think I will have to answer two different ways to that question as well, because there's stakes at home, so to speak, and then there's the broader stakes, because I mean, as a white person teaching Black studies at a primarily white university in a primarily white country, what is at stake there is, it's actually interesting in itself. I mean, for me, it's crucial to talk with the students about Black history, about Black intellectual contribution, about Black feminism, also as a way to adjust the thinking that feminism should be only one thing, and actually to show the limits of a lot of theories and a lot of scholars they have read before they come to me. Because I mean, I know that that focusing so much on Black studies as I do, it's not that many musicologists in the Scandinavian countries that do. So and I think that stake is actually also extremely important, to sort of be self-critical within a European university context. It's not necessarily that we can translate every US discourse into our own world, but we can use Black scholars' work to distinguish between how a cultural field of power has influenced intellectual movements, and we can probably be better that and seeing immigrants and refugees and so on in our own country, rather than a lot of hostility that has been from time to time. I see, actually, I can learn something from Afrofuturism into how do we want a future to develop where we can accept a huge part of cultural differences. So that it sounds like a kind of liberal kumbaya moment, but it's more than that. It's really sort of trying to teach the students that you might actually have learned to think in only one way, and there are other ways of thinking, and you need to do that. As Sun Ra said, or one of the tracks, there are other worlds they have not told you about. And I think that they're kind of opening up to a multiplicity of worlds existing, actually, is a kind of a speculative way of illustrating that different communities have different rules and practices that actually influence how the world is perceived. And that is a gift to humanity. That's not a problem. It's really, really great to be able to meet people that you can go into a conversation about seeing the world from different perspectives, and what can you learn from that multi perspectivity. So that's one thing, and that's also when I write about Afrofuturism, that's primarily to a scholarly community. I also try to do some music journalism from time to time, but then also to sort of always be self-critical towards the discipline, to say, if we write about music and gender, we also need to think about race. We shouldn't just think that gender studies is not a finished project either. There's so much to learn about from Black feminist scholars. And I say to colleagues in doing gender studies, if you haven't read Black feminists, you need to do that, or you need to stop teaching feminism, because you cannot teach feminism as if Black feminism is not a really, really important conversation to include into it. And luckily, a lot of things are happening. And I think that the Afrofuturist discussion contributes to similar moment. In the sense that as far as I can understand, also within the field of Black studies, there are important conversations to discuss where Afrofuturism contributes, not only a speculative dimension, but also just some new questions that seemed to have been settled. And Afrofuturism show, no, they weren't settled. These questions are still with us. And Afrofuturism come in as a moment to remind, to keep the questions open. And of course, one of the things that stuck me early in my work was Because, yes, I admit I hadn't thought about it, but it was the first time I read from a Black scholar about going to the movies and seeing science fiction films and not seeing a single Black person in the future. I know there are sci-fi films with Black persons, of course, but major Hollywood productions. And I saw, I think it was a newspaper article or whatever, and I don't remember the author. I'm sorry about that. I remember Yutasha Womack writes something similar in her book, but I had seen other people say something that, and I was so, first I got surprised, and then I got sad, and then I said, that can't be right. It's kind of thing, growing up and seeing that there's a future where the people producing art, they don't think there will be people like me there. I found that a really, really sad, but also really important story in the sense of we have to do something about it. We have to, when we think about the future, we need to think that the diversity that makes up the human race, we are actually all going to be in that future one way or another. And I think that stake actually is one of the things that Afrofuturist brings out, and thus is important to teach to younger people that the future is not decided by the 1%, even if some of them think they will. And thus it's actually also a political fight here and now to see who among our political leaders, who among our tech companies, who among our professors are actually thinking about the future we would like to inhabit.
That's a great point. My last question for you is the question that's impossible to answer, but I always like to ask it, in part because it is the nature of the beast. And when you're thinking about intellectual movement, where do you see something like Afrofuturism and sound going? Like, where, what are the trends? What are the patterns? What are the potentialities in terms of this kind of work?
Yeah. I think that there's one moment that I'm definitely not true thinking about, but I know that Nnedi Okorafor wants to speak about her literature as African futurism rather than Afrofuturism. And I admit at first I didn't quite understand why that distinction should be important, but I'm gradually getting to understand it. And I think that's one of the things that is important. I think the discussion about on the intellectual level, the discussion about the US centric dimension and a global dimension, when we talk about Blackness, do we talk about US Black, or do we talk about some other kind of Blackness that is global? I think that is a conversation that will happen, but I have no idea how it will unfold, but I can see that's an important question now. And it's, in my field, also an important question related to what kind of music are you talking about? I think talking about music by Black Europeans would be something that would be interesting to do also in relation to Afrofuturism, simply to sort of destabilize the conversation from the US conversation, because I think it's strong enough that it can be destabilized, and I think that can come some interesting conversation out of it. So that is two things I see. And then I also think that expanding the historical material, digging the crates, finding more music that can be brought into the historical conversation, more literature that can be brought into it, will be important. And then I think that there's something about technology and the technological developments now that will mean that we have to address the questions anew. And I'm thinking when Alondra Nelson wrote that introduction to social text issue, she wrote about the digital divide. Then we got Then we got our upgraded cell phones, and we are online all the time. So suddenly the digital divide is a bit different conceptualizing. But now we have all kinds of artificial intelligence and technology development, which everything points to have some racial biases inscribed in the technology. And I think that sort of the surveillance technology and how technology is used, are we continuing? Are the tech companies today continuing to experiment on black bodies like history has told us that a lot of both medicine and so on was doing? So we see a slight shift in some cultural sphere, and the art will go along with it. I mean, there's a lot of artificial intelligence produced music these days. What is happening if artificial intelligence is producing music? What kind of futuristic game is that? And what kind of exploitation of musicians? And so I think that all the societal, all the technological development that we see around us will mean that if we are awake to what is happening around us, and I cannot see Afrofuturists not being that, because that's part of the job, that then we will continue, we will get new questions all the time that we need to ask to the same material, and we just have to stay awake and also encourage the next generation of scholars to question us and to sort of continue both expanding and focusing on material. So I mean, we have all seen these editorials where starting with Afrofuturism is an emerging field of study and so on. And I think it's almost time now to stop talking about it as emerging, because now it's a pretty stable field of discourse, and we need to take that upon ourselves and see, okay, where do we go from here? What kind of conversations? And I can hear myself now sort of engaging into it, and I like that. But I just sitting here in Scandinavia arguing for this feels also a bit strange. I mean, that is the last part of answering your question, because there's something about my position where I sort of feel that I should be a follower. I should let someone else point out where they want this conversation to go. But I would like to be a part of the conversation, and I would also like to sort of be corrected when I don't understand what is happening. But those technology questions, at least they are there. But what the artists will do, what kind of art will develop out of this Afrofuturist moment, that's much harder to say. But I mean, I'm more of an interpreter of the art that is already there than predicting how art will develop.
No, and that's a great answer. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for some great, insightful answers.
Thank you.